When President Biden took office this time last year, his agenda was to transform the country by defeating the coronavirus, bolstering the economy, and bringing unity to a divided country.
This is America's day. This is democracy's day, a day of history and hope, of renewal and resolve. Through a crucible for the ages, America has been tested anew, and America has risen to the challenge. Today, we celebrate the triumph not of a candidate, but of a cause, the cause of democracy.
Many said we hadn't seen an agenda this ambitious since FDR. But 1 year later, where are we? For this analysis, let's bring in Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington correspondent and editor, who joins us now for a look at Biden's first year. Ron, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tanya.
Biden held a long news conference yesterday, which is kind of rare for him. And one thing that stood out was his remarks on the possibility that Russia will invade Ukraine. Let's listen.
Russia will be held accountable if it invades. And it depends on what it does. It's one thing if it's a minor incursion and then we end up having a fight about what to do and not do, et cetera. But if they actually do what they're capable of doing with the force amassed on the border, it is going to be a disaster for Russia.
Ron, this could be the biggest international crisis for the presidency. In what ways is this a test of Biden's leadership?
It's a test in every way. First, as a national security leader. Secondly, as an international negotiator. And third, as a person who has to communicate all of this in simple and compelling terms to the American people. And at this point, you'd have to say that the jury was out with respect to his performance on all three. It was an awkward remark in a press conference at a fraught moment in the international relationships and negotiation. And it involves an exceedingly complicated web of relationships, not only the United States and Russia, but the United States and NATO, which is made up of a number of constituent parts, different countries with different interests, some of which are dependent on Russia for natural gas. That's how they heat their homes in the wintertime. So this is all complicated. And when the president said that we would have to consider how we were going to respond as an alliance if the Russians made a limited incursion, he was committing what we sometimes call a Washington gaffe, Tanya. This is when you speak truth into an open microphone at an inopportune time. And what the president was saying was it will make a difference to our allies and how they want to respond if the Russians make some sort of cyber attack or some other sort of limited incursion, but do not actually send tanks rolling across the border. And that is simply the truth.
This point that you're making here, though, about the president misspeaking, people do misspeak, but this is a moment where every word spoken about what's happening has consequence.
Absolutely. And the White House was immediately about cleaning up those remarks, as we say. The president's spokesperson was out to talk about what he really meant. And of course, the president himself has put out another statement saying that the Russians understand that we are going to resist with massive sanctions if they make a military move against Ukraine. What perhaps the president is trying, and we have to say perhaps because we don't know what's actually in his mind, but what he might be doing would be signaling that there could be some modulation in terms of the response if, in fact, there were no actual military assets involved. Now, that's a fine point, perhaps, but an important one, certainly in terms of European history. And it's important to our allies because Germany, for example, has to sell to their polity, their political situation, some sort of major response to what might to many Germans with chilly homes seem excessive. So all of that has to be negotiated and brought to bear.
Ron, let's turn now to Biden's domestic agenda. Just last night, his effort to pass voting rights legislation failed, and it failed because he didn't have the support of two key Democratic senators who voted against changing the filibuster rules so that Republicans couldn't block the legislation. He has framed protecting voting rights as crucial to ensuring free and fair elections and for protecting our democracy. Why can't he deliver on this? What is he missing?
What he's missing is the United States Senate. And this is something he knows well. He served multiple terms in the Senate, starting when he was barely 30 years old. And he knows that the Senate operates the way it does. You need to break the filibuster if you want to pass something that is not supported by the opposition party. So to break the filibuster, you need 60 votes. You could conceivably change the rules of the filibuster if you had the united support of all the Democrats, as in fact they had when they passed the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan back last spring. No Republicans supported that, but they got it done with just Democratic votes because they had a special procedure they could use if all 50 Democrats were in favor of it. But this is really a nominal Democratic majority. It's only 50-50, and you have to get all 50 to force a tie and bring in Vice President Kamala Harris to break that tie. That's the only way the Democrats are the majority. So lacking two, you can call them key senators, but any senator would be the key senator if he or she chose to withhold his or her vote on any issue. And so that's what they've been dealing with all year long. This is what sank the attempt to do the Build Back Better plan. And this is what sank voting rights in the last analysis, because those two Democrats you mentioned are not willing to change the filibuster.
Well, with the Build Back Better bill, the president has said he's considering breaking off pieces of the $2 trillion price tag to pass it bit by bit. Is this a better strategy? And if so, should he have done it a long time ago?
You know, this really harks back to when Joe Biden lost his chance to be either FDR or LBJ. And it was a lot earlier than most people realize. It was November of 2020 when he did not gain seats in the House, but only barely managed to hold on to the House with a bare majority of just a handful. Which means that any faction in the House can break away and sink anything you want to do. Now, it's 50-50 in the Senate, so that's not even a majority in real terms. But in the House, too, it's an extraordinarily narrow, historically narrow majority. So if you broke up the Build Back Better bill and you started dropping out some of the parts that matter most to some of those members of the House, and then, of course, the same could be true in the Senate, you're going to lose your operating majority in either party. That's why they didn't do it last year. They thought if they put everything together and had everybody's baggage on the train, that everybody would want the train to roll. And they almost got there, but again, came up short in the Senate, just barely, as we discussed.
I want to talk with you as well about another huge issue that we talked about quite extensively during the election, but not as of late, and that is the issue of immigration reform. It was so prominent. Biden had big promises that we have yet to see. Why is that?
The immigration problem is the immigration problem. There is a collision between the authorities of the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judiciary. And so every effort that has been made by the last, well, three presidents, all the way back to Obama, certainly President Trump, to make a move of a dramatic fashion to address the immigration problem in one sense or another, very different moves, has run up against either opposition in the Congress, which frustrated President Trump, or opposition in the courts, which frustrated President Obama and has continued to frustrate the Biden administration, because efforts to liberalize, on the one hand, run up against federal judges who rule against that, and efforts to do something like building a wall have run up against opposition in the Congress. So without some unity between the parties, with some unity even within the parties, and some unity between the branches of government, the sort of major overhaul that's needed in our immigration reform is not going to happen.
I mean, more broadly, the president acknowledged yesterday that bipartisanship has not worked. He's tried many ways to reach consensus. Is it time to give up that effort and fight?
In a sense, that is what has already happened. We saw a bipartisan effort on the infrastructure bill. 17 Republicans came over to vote for the infrastructure bill, $1 trillion benefiting every state. Even the Senate Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, came over and supported that. He was one of the 17. They were denounced, by the way, by former President Trump, who kept insisting they shouldn't vote for such a thing and help Biden. Now, he had been president for 4 years and talking about an infrastructure bill and couldn't get it done. That was one of the signal successes of the first Biden year, and it did involve bipartisanship. But on practically every other issue, certainly every other issue of major consequence, Mitch McConnell has held together his 50 Republicans. And remember, he has half the chamber, and they have been able to frustrate the Democrats and President Biden at every turn.
I have about 30 seconds with you, and I'm actually about to ask you the biggest question with 30 seconds. Midterms are coming up in November. Democrats could lose the House and the Senate. What's Biden's path forward?
His path forward is to accomplish as much as possible in pieces of what they tried to do with an overarching plan. And that would help. But the difficulty here is that in midterm elections, the president's party usually takes a beating. And there needs to be some signal reason why this year would be different. And we'll have to wait for that to emerge.
Ron Elving is NPR senior Washington correspondent and editor. As always, thank you.
Thank you, Tanya.